Welcome back to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Cressy, and this is episode 176. I'm flying solo for today's episode as I tackle what I think is not necessarily a controversial topic, but is definitely an underappreciated topic. I'm going to be talking about warm-ups. Obviously, nobody loves to warm up, but I think we all recognize that they are important. So what I really want to use today for is to talk about the rationale for warm-up, what the critical competencies that we need to hit are, and what the benefits are. And really, above all else, beyond just making a case for them, I want to make sure that we at least have a discussion about how to use them most efficiently. Nobody wants to spend 45 minutes warming up when 20 can do. So we're going to talk about the need for it, as well as the practical application that hopefully makes this an effective podcast for not just players, but coaches who are writing up these warmups for their athletes. This episode is brought to you by AG1, the most comprehensive NSF certified for sport daily nutritional supplement I've ever tried. With so many stressors in life, it can be difficult to maintain effective nutritional habits and give our bodies the nutrients they need to thrive. As a father of three young kids and a co-founder of multiple businesses in multiple states, on top of still being an avid exerciser, I know that busy schedules can really take their toll on us. Whether it's poor sleep, exercise or life stressors, environmental factors, or simply not eating enough of the right foods, we can often wind up deficient nutritionally. This is where AG1 can really help. It's a game-changing nutritional insurance policy. They simplify the logistics of getting optimal nutrition on a daily basis by giving you just one thing with all the best things. That's why I use it daily, as do several of my family members, and we recommend it to a lot of our top athletes. One scoop of AG1 contains 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients that work together to fill the nutritional gaps in your diet to support energy, focus, digestion, and recovery. And this can all happen for less than $3 per day and without taking multiple products. While most nutritional supplements come to market and stay stagnant, AG1 continues to obsessively improve this one holistic formula based on the latest research, producing over 50 improvements in the last decade alone. They invest in the most absorbable and natural source of each ingredient and go above and beyond in third-party testing to ensure their customers continue to receive the highest quality and best-tasting nutrition habit on the planet. Whether you're keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free, it'll work for you, and it contains less than 1 gram of sugar per serving. They put 75 ingredients through the rigorous NSF certification test to come up with a safe formula that's trusted by some of the world's top athletes, including many of our own at Cressy Sports Performance. Right now, AG1 is giving our listeners a special offer of 10 free travel packets with their first purchase. Just head to drinkag1.com/Cressy and claim this special offer. These travel packets are perfect for supporting your immune system, energy, and gut health while you're traveling for games, training, or simply on the go. They can be great counterbalance to the less than ideal on the road food options that are out there for a lot of our traveling baseball players. So if you want to bridge the gap between deficient and optimal and give yourself the best chance of getting nutrient diversity, head to drinkag1.com/Cressy to get 10 free travel packets with your first purchase. Again, that's drinkag1.com/Cressy, C-R-E-S-S-E-Y. You won't regret it. We are going to kick off this podcast with the obvious. Nobody really enjoys warming up. I am not excluded from this. I'm a guy who may be on my feet for 10 hours and then have to work out at the end of the day. And the last thing I want to do is go through a crazy involved warm-up before I lift when I'm racing home to see my kids and have dinner and put them into bed. So nobody is immune to this, but I think baseball is a population that has to pay specific attention to it. And the reason for that is very simple. You play a ton of games. So there's a lot of exposures. You might not just play 162 games at the big league level, but if you throw on spring training, you throw on postseason games, it may be 200 games in 230 days. You may play 30 games in 31 days in a month. And the other thing that's interesting about baseball is there's a lot of hurry up and wait, right? So maybe players get to the field, they have to warm up to go out and throw for pregame or take infield, outfield, or take BP. And then they go and they sit down for 2 hours. Maybe they have a meal and then they've got to warm up again before the game. So if you have someone who's a chronic warm up skipper, you know, they may miss out on, you know, 700, 800, 900, 1,000 exposures to good mobility training over the course of a long competitive season. So it's just really important in a baseball population, probably more than any other athletic endeavor, to really be locked in warmups. So first, I think it's important that we make the case for why we need to warm up. And I think the best description I've ever heard came from Thomas Kurtz in The Science of Sports Training. It was published all the way back in 2001. And on the warm-up period, he said it's about improved elasticity and contractibility of muscles, greater efficiency of the respiratory and cardiovascular systems, a shorter reaction time, improved perception, better concentration, improved coordination, and regulation of emotional states. And I couldn't agree with this anymore. Beyond just the physiological benefits of, you know, getting your body temperature up and improving joint range of motion and things like that, there does seem to be a really, really profound impact of that regulation of emotional states component, where people just need to figure out how to transition from rest to exercise or rest to competition. You don't want to just go from parasympathetic to sympathetic immediately. There seems to be a need for a gradual onboarding. So we use the warmups a lot to optimize neuromuscular recruitment. Maybe it's an opportunity for us to teach a new skill, you know, in the non-competitive sense. Or it's a scenario where, hey, we want to really teach this guy how to get into his hip. Let's use some good 3D strap rotations to really work on it. Maybe it's an opportunity for us to shorten the learning loop. If there's a skill that we really want to hammer home that they're trying to acquire, let's give them some drills that, you know, basically prep them for going out there and being really successful. This might be, you know, guys throwing plyo balls before they go and pick up a 5-ounce baseball. It gives them a chance to pattern something that's hopefully going to become part of a more comprehensive delivery. And then I think also we look at the warm-up as an opportunity to establish stability within the new range of motion. We aren't just going out and trying to, you know, create more range of motion, particularly passive range of motion. We're trying to create usable range of motion, you know, a pattern that people actually have motor control into. So it's vitally important for us not just to go out and static stretch, but rather to get people moving and actually establish some good awareness of how to control any new range of motion they may acquire. Now, in light of all these proposed benefits, it should come as no surprise that warm-ups are very important across a number of different populations and have actually been really well researched. So if you've read and listened to my stuff over the years, you've appreciated that I'm a big advocate for high quality warm-ups as a way to, you know, optimize subsequent performance and reduce the risk of injury. However, I have to admit that most of my writing in this regard has been focused on more advanced and older populations. In other words, professional baseball players, you know, adult athletes who are trying to stay fit and involved in competitive things. Whereas in baseball, you know, other disciplines for younger athletes, I haven't necessarily given them as much attention. So, you know, some of the youth sports warmups you'll see are far from comprehensive if you go to your standard, you know, little league field. And that's if they're actually present at all. You know, we tend to see a few arm circles and then jog out to the fence and back and you're good to go. You know, fortunately, I've got a chance now with this platform to correct this oversight by highlighting a recent meta-analysis. It was actually in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health. It's titled Effectiveness of Warm-Up Intervention Programs to Prevent Sports Injuries Among Children and Adolescents. And basically what it was a, you know, it's a meta-analysis, right? It's a brief synopsis of a ton of hard work by a lot of different, you know, researchers that are, you know, now compiled by Ding et al. And they looked at 15 meticulously selected studies of 21,576 total athletes. And the ages were 7 to 18. And they found that when they looked at all these studies, a 15 to 20 minute warm-up reduced the risk of injury by 36% in the following, you know, period of time that they tracked. So beyond the obvious benefits of staying healthy, what's interesting about this outcome to me is that a variety of different warm-up initiatives worked to deliver this injury reduction. So in older, more trained populations, more of the benefits are probably coming from increases in body temperature and in turn tissue extensibility. They're less likely to go out and strain something because they've actually created a little bit more range of motion that they can tap into. Conversely, in a younger, more untrained population, we see in this meta-analysis, you're probably getting more chronic protection from injury because the warm-ups are delivering actual training effect. They're giving them better balance. They're adding strength. They're optimizing landing mechanics and attacking a number of other factors. And this is something that makes me think we can always benefit from doing some microdosing of important training initiatives while they're athletes. And the warm-ups are one avenue through which coaches can sneak in extra reps to optimize movement quality. It's interesting to consider whether the benefits would have been pronounced if the drills were done at different times with these athletes as opposed to just in the warm-up initiatives. But, you know, good adaptation is good adaptation, and the warm-ups are probably the best way, you know, to guarantee accountability in this group environment rather than saying, all right, everybody go home and do these exercises after soccer practice. And speaking anecdotally, it's not uncommon for in-season, you know, veteran big leaguers to do almost mini lifts as part of their daily warmups. If they don't feel like going out and attacking like two heavier, longer full body lifts per week, they might sneak in 4 to 6 sets into their pregame warmup. And, you know, in those situations, they've thrived, and it's a way to consolidate stress. As a follow-up to that last study, I do think it's useful to talk about the FIFA 11 program. So this was a, you know, organized initiative across the soccer community to really prioritize injury prevention worldwide. And Sadagursky et al. In 2017 did a meta-analysis of 6 studies featuring 6,344 players who utilized the FIFA 11 program. And they averaged a 30% reduction in injuries in soccer players. In the intervention group, they saw 779, so 24% of players had injuries, while in the control group, 1,219, so 40% of players had injuries. So it went from 40% to 24%. That's a really big deal. What's really interesting about the FIFA 11 program is it's actually pretty mundane. You wouldn't call this like high level, you know, competencies or anything like that. It's stuff that's meant to be simple and rolled out on a field for, you know, kids who may not need a lot of coaching. It's a little bit more soccer specific, where they'll actually like do fake headers and simulate contact and things like that. But at the end of the day, if you broke it down, it's 8 minutes of running slash change of direction. It's 10 minutes of what you would call strength and conditioning, and it's two minutes of high speed running. So what's fascinating about that is it's very different than what we would consider classic warmups, you know, your toe touches and a lot of your stretches and even dynamic flexibility drills. It's actually much more of kind of a training intervention for these young athletes. So it's interesting to show you that at these youth populations, like I mentioned before, they're probably benefiting even more from adding good motor control to the system as opposed to just attacking, you know, more and more range of motion. So with that said, I think it's also vitally important that we actually look at maybe some examples specific to the baseball world. So, you know, if we're looking at these FIFA 11 studies, they're obviously looking at how soccer players do. And there is actually some pretty good research in the American Journal of Sports Medicine in 2019, throwing injuries in youth baseball players. Can a prevention program help? A randomized controlled trial. So the lead author on this is Sakata. And basically, they blocked 16 youth baseball teams, which was 237 total players from ages 9 to 11 into an intervention group. So there were basically 8 teams of 117 players that, and then a control group of 8 teams, 120 players. They did an intervention program with the intervention group. It was 5 stretching, 2 dynamic mobility, and 2 balanced training exercises performed during the warm-up. And they followed both groups for 12 months. And they followed the incidence of shoulder and elbow injuries. They also tracked ball speed during pitching as a, you know, performance related variable. And they looked at other variables of physical function. So things like passive range of motion of the elbow, shoulder, and hip. They did a dynamic balance test. And then they look at the thoracic kyphosis angle, both pre-test and post-test. And when they looked at the injuries in the intervention group, they saw 1.7 injuries per 1,000 athlete exposures, which was significantly lower than that in the control group. So 3.1 per athlete exposures. So it was a, you know, almost cut it in half comparatively. You know, and the factors that were related to pitching performance, when they looked at ball speed, they tended to increase in the intervention group. It wasn't statistically significant. But the program also improved shoulder horizontal adduction, deficits on the dominant side, improved hip internal rotation, and then improved the kyphosis angle. So, really an interesting dynamic in play where, we're recognizing that just about anything works in young populations, but it is good to know that we do see some more specific adaptations when we target that program just a little bit more for our baseball athletes who obviously have unique demands with respect to the shoulder. So when I come back to all this, you try to wrap your head around what is the ideal warm-up look like? So for me, there are key components to any high-quality warm-up. However, before we can even discuss actual warmups, we need to discuss preparation before the session. So things like hydration, nutritional factors, adequate sleep in the night before are really, really important, right? Anyone who's ever been sick with the flu and just felt tight all over realizes that there can be a pretty pronounced impact of physiological stress, whether that's dehydration, sleep deprivation, whatever it may be, on how joints function, how much extensibility we feel in those tissues. So those are really important considerations where if you're someone who is often feeling terrible and that the warmups are really, really hard, it may be that you're, underhydrated or you just haven't slept enough. I also would add attire, particularly being a guy who grew up in Southern Maine, playing tennis in the spring. We had a lot of practices where you're dressing in layers and kind of removing layers as you build the sweat. So, you know, in the baseball world, you know, we always hear about warm up to throw, don't throw to warm up. So I do think there's something to be said about not picking up a baseball or a baseball bat until you actually have a little bit of a sweat on. Additionally, I'd even add just the ability to turn off the outside world. A lot of people can't seem to put their cell phone down long enough to actually get a high quality warm up in that'll get their body temperature up. I think that's really big. And also you need to create a culture where if you have 7 or 8 athletes that are warming up at the same time, and there's one athlete that's talking the whole time and distracting people and holding things up and cutting reps short, that culture can have a definite downstream negative impact on what you're trying to accomplish. And then last but not least, remember, before you ever get to the true competencies underneath the umbrella of warmups, you may have to recognize that for some athletes, you have to sell it, where they may not be bought in on doing it. Maybe you need to be a little bit reductionist and really emphasize training economy and minimum effective dose where, hey, instead of doing 12 exercises, we're going to start with these 4, really own them. Once you notice the difference, we can talk about expanding and building things out from there.
We interrupt this podcast with a quick reminder that this episode is brought to you by AG1. It's an NSF-certified all-in-one superfood supplement that features 75 whole food-sourced ingredients designed to support your body's nutritional needs. I use this product daily myself, and a ton of our athletes do as well. Head to drinkag1.com/Cressy and claim my special offer of 10 free travel packets with your first purchase. AG1 gives you peace of mind that you're covering all your nutritional bases. Again, that's drinkag1.com/Cressy, Cressey, and you'll get that special offer.
Now that we actually get to our warm-up, some of our considerations really relate to duration, right? A warm-up might need to be considerably longer for an athlete who has a lot of stiffness versus an athlete who's really loose. The tighter they are, the longer the warm-up, the looser they are, the more stability-oriented and generally shorter the warm-ups may be. They don't have as much tissue extensibility that they have to overcome. Weather conditions may actually impact this quite a bit. A warm-up might need to be longer if it's colder outside. And then you also, you know, may have, you know, situations where the flow of a game responsibility might actually drive what you have time for. So if you're a relief pitcher, you don't have nearly as much time as a starting pitcher to warm up. In many cases, those are athletes that need to kind of stay warm throughout the game because their number could be called at any point. We try to take into account the flow of the facility or the field. In Major League Baseball, you see a lot of players that do the majority of their warmups inside where they may use a hot tub and then get a manual stretch from a training staff member and then go through their foam rolling, their dynamic prep series, throw the med balls, throw some plyo care stuff, you know, before they ever even go and put their uniform on to head out to the field to start their catch play, their pregame bullpen, and then actually go pitch in the game. So, you know, the flow of facility is really, really important. You don't have those amenities sometimes when you're on the road playing college baseball and, you know, in the middle of nowhere or something like that. Certainly your sporting position, you know, requires different things. A first baseman probably isn't going to need to warm up exactly the same as a center fielder who may cover a lot more yardage in a game. Certainly, you know, a relief pitcher is not going to warm up pregame like a shortstop would, just because the time of the activity is going to be at a different point. And then last but not least, fitness level, probably not as big of a consideration for our baseball athletes, but in our general population, there are athletes that are so deconditioned that you go through a warm-up and it actually feels like a workout. So they, you know, their heart rate may be really, really heavily spiked by doing things. So you may have to get a little bit more reductionist with what you do. Once you've worked past all of these different considerations, I think we need to really get to the good stuff. So, you know, what do I like to talk about? Well, first thing, I always look at soft tissue work. And right now we're in a time where foam rolling is really getting poo-pooed. And, you know, it may not be for everybody, but I do think some kind of intervention on the manual therapy or self-myofascial release side of things is really important. You know, at the professional level, athletes can go and, you know, get an elbow in their QL, or they can get some dry needling pregame if they want to. They can get a lot of different things if they want to have an intervention that transiently and reduces some stiffness, you know, in the same way that if you popped an AcuMobility ball, you know, on your scalenes or your sternocleidomastoid or your subclavius, something just to get your neck moving a little bit better. You know, athletes at the highest level just seem to have more amenities there. But for younger athletes, you know, I think hopping on a foam roller or using a lacrosse ball or a baseball just to get some tissue tone reduction, you know, in certain spots is really important. I don't think that needs to be 20 minutes. I think it could be 3 to 5 minutes where you just hit the spots that need the most love, and things usually go from there. Once you're done with that self-myofascial release or manual therapy, I like to go to some positional breathing drills. So things that have been influenced, you know, by Postural Restoration Institute, traditional yoga practices, some of Bill Hartman's, you know, expansion compression model. Zach Couples' work has been great in this regard as well. You know, why do we use breathing drills? One, well, it really addresses both mobility and stability simultaneously, right? We're getting expansion of our rib cage in the desired direction. It's a way to shift away from kind of this constant state of inhalation to exhalation for a heavily extended athlete. It sometimes can be a transient shift towards a little bit more of a parasympathetic state when we're trying to, you know, really regain some motion. But at the end of the day, it also helps to make patterns stick, right? So if you're a wide infrasternal angle and you do a really forceful exhale where you're thinking of blowing out the birthday candles, you can do it right now while you're listening to this podcast. That exhale, when you blow it all out, you're going to feel your rectus abdominis, your external obliques. They're going to really turn on to force that air out and try to close down that infrasternal angle. And they actually create some better stiffness in a place where we actually want it. So positional breathing drills based on how we position ourselves, how we reach, and how we cue the respiratory aspect of things can do a lot to both establish range of motion and create some motor control in those ranges of motion. Building on that positional breathing, we're down in on the ground in most cases, so it's a good time to go right to some ground-based mobility and stability drills. These can be basic things like bird dogs, prone hip extensions. They can be rolling patterns. They can be bear crawl patterns. They can be a lot of different things, but, you know, I like adductor stretch with extension rotation, 90-90 hip switches. All those things can be really good. And we do it, you know, basically to gradually introduce athletes to more significant ranges of motion, but we do it without exposing them to the velocities that they might encounter, you know, in actual athletic participation or our training session. So it's a gradual way to build some body temperature up before we start to attack those extreme end ranges at higher velocity. Once we've done some stuff ground-based, then we'll get up and do some standing stuff. Maybe it's a forward and reverse lunge with cross connect and knee hug to lateral lunge with overhead reach, you know, walking Spider-Man with hip lift and overhead reach, just things to get people moving a little bit more. So continue to expose them to larger joint ranges of motion, multi-joint movements where the body temperature is getting up further and further. At this point, we should see athletes starting to sweat a little bit more. And this is the time when I would start to look at more like movement sprint slash power progressions, maybe some of your classic like track and field warmups with, you know, some skipping variations and easier plyos, pogos, things like that. Certainly a time to look at, you know, karaoke, side shuffle with overhead reach, you know, some lateral skipping progressions, Haydn's, you know, rotational and overhead med ball exercises. I like to incorporate some single leg balance with athletes potentially here, just things to get them a little bit more engaged. A lot of receive and release exercises can be great just because it's also a way to tap into like a little bit of a challenge, make them compete a little bit more. And then, you know, once we finish that up, we might mix in a little bit of technique work. I wouldn't do this in a competitive landscape, but I might use this in a training world where, say, we're doing a Monday lower body lift, and on Friday, we were trying to teach an athlete how to do a Turkish getup, and they were just really struggling with the technique. That's a perfect time for us to say, hey, let's grab a set of three on each side with the Turkish getup, take a lightweight, let's just pattern this, little quick reminder, you know, so that we're not going a full week before we come back to it. It's a chance to just get some high quality reps in when they're, you know, they're not fatigued and they're technically in a good position to acquire those movements. And then last but not least, if we are talking about something that's really baseball specific, you know, a lot of athletes do like to do a shoulder stretch of some sort, you know, some sort, maybe an elbow stretch, you know, at the higher levels, generally as an athletic trainer that's stretching guys out. I like the idea of stretching them after they've gone through this full warm-up because it's the closest to the game and we can usually follow it up with some end range rotator cuff drills. There is also a little bit of evidence to suggest that if you do like your shoulder stretch on the front end when you're cold, then you go to the dynamic warm-up, you come back to it, and you might not still have all that range of motion. Probably has a lot to do with maybe training out of neutral a little bit if the warm-ups aren't great. But I just like the idea of get the body temperature up, work proximal to distal, get your ribs where they need to be with your soft tissue work and your positional breathing, and then obviously gradually work your way out. So that way you're not taking a delicate joint like a shoulder and really aggressively stretching it unless you absolutely have to. So I like the idea of like the last thing being the shoulder stretch before the athlete, you know, on the pro side, like throws their uniform on and starts doing their plyo care drills and, you know, some of their, in some cases, med ball stuff, even with their cleats on, and then goes out and then starts long tossing, or in the case of hitters, you know, actually gets in the cages and starts to swing a little bit more. I think those really serve us well. And then obviously the last portion of the warm up is something that's very skill specific, right? It's the actual throwing portion. What I think we see a lot in the younger groups is kids come out really hot, right? Their first throw is 85. When in reality, when you look at some of the best arms in the history of baseball, they have a really good awareness of how to play catch, just flip things early on and gradually build up the intensity, the distance. I love the quote from Alan Jager with respect to long toss. He talks a lot about it. Impress me on the way in, not on the way out. So on the way out, it's a little bit of, you know, have a good lather and put a little air under it. And as you start to work your way back in, that's when you're stepping on a little bit more so that, you know, you finish with a brief flat ground and then you get on the mound and good things happen. I think the same is true of a lot of guys when they get into the cages. They're not trying to hit balls, you know, 115 miles an hour in the first swing. Rather, they're trying to gradually build up and get there over the course of time. So big picture, we talk about the sequencing of warm up, you know, get your mind right, you know, get your nutrition, your sleep, you know, aspect of things, your hydration, all those things right. Get in a good culture of warm ups. And then once you get to the sequencing, you're looking at soft tissue work. You're looking at positional breathing. You're looking at both ground based and then standing / moving mobility / stability drills. Then you're looking at movement / sprint / power progressions, including rotational stuff, maybe a little bit of technique work, and then you're getting actually to the traditional stretching program. This is not a throw to warm up. It's very much a warm up to throw approach where we're appreciating that throwing a baseball is the single fastest motion in all of sports. So we need to take a lot of care and precision with our warm ups to make sure that we're doing a really good job of preparing ourselves for the demands that are ahead. Now, to tie a bow on this, I think as we put this all together, you know, our self-myofascial release is really 3 to 5 minutes. We have 1 to 2 positional breathing exercises, which may take 1 to 2 minutes. We have some ground-based mobility / stability exercise. 2 to 3 of those is 2 to 3 minutes. Some standing exercises, you know, 3 to 4 of them for 3 to 4 minutes. You have some movement progressions of 2 to 3 exercises, 2 to 3 minutes. You do some kind of power development exercise. You can mix in some kind of corrective with them, 4 to 6 minutes. So you're looking at really 17 to 20 minutes to really get a good warm up in before you pick up, you know, a baseball or a baseball bat and really start getting to it. As a good rule of thumb, the less training experience that you or your client / athlete has, the more important it is for you to, appreciate that the warm up actually might be a workout in and of itself. And I think that's what we see with some of the FIFA 11 programs and things like that. They confer an amazing amount of benefit on these kids because they're so detrained that they're actually creating a strength and conditioning emphasis. You're not going to get that benefit, with a minimalist approach with more advanced athletes. So, generally speaking, the warmups are going to have to be longer for your more veteran athletes, not just because, you know, they have, more tissue extensibility challenges that they have to overcome as they age, but also simply because they may have more wear and tear, little things that they've acquired over the years that they need to kind of work through. So less trained athletes, make it more of a training session as part of the warmup. More advanced athletes, you can get a little bit, longer with it because you have so many more loose ends that you need to tie up. So we want to make sure that things are efficient while still covering everything that we need to cover. So, you know, the big things are, you know, training economy, understanding minimum effective dose, but also just being aware of the concept of relative stiffness in terms of always understanding if you're going to stretch something, why are you stretching it? Why is it tight? And then if you're going to put stability / motor control somewhere, why are you doing it? What changes are you trying to hold? So I'd really encourage you to dig in on the concept of relative stiffness as a follow-up if you really want to work hard on trying to optimize your warm-ups for your athletes. That's all I've got for today. Thanks so much for listening and look forward to seeing you back next week. Thanks so much for tuning in to the CSP Elite Baseball Development Podcast. We really appreciate you carving out some time in your schedule to listen, not just to this episode, but also to some of the episodes from our archives. If you enjoy what you heard, we'd love it if you'd share it with friends, colleagues, and teammates, as well as leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks again for your time.